Gary Roy is here with a wonderful, I saw a little bit of a preview of this, some very, very early Doc Watson. I am a big fan of those earliest recordings that Ralph Rinzler and Gene Earle made of Doc and Clarence Ashley and some of the wonderful records that were made in the Watson home of some of the a cappella singing. And Gary is going to be talking about that. We're running a little bit late, so I'm not going to spiel too much. And are you ready? Is the technology ready? Who could ask for more? Gary Roy.
Thank you, Dick. Let's see. Let me write down the time here so I know when I started. It's great to be back in the Triangle. I actually got my PhD from Duke University a few miles up the road here and a master's degree from Chapel Hill. So this is sort of old stomping grounds for me. I left this area in 2000 to go to Appalachian State University. I knew two things about Appalachian State at that time. I knew the most important thing, which is that it's Appalachian, not Appalachian State. And I also knew that it was near the home of Doc Watson, because I was a big Doc Watson fan. Deep Gap, North Carolina is about 10 miles up the road from Boone, North Carolina, which is where Appalachian State is. So it was great to be in the area of Doc Watson. And just this semester, I was able to teach a graduate seminar called The Music of Doc and Merle Watson. I think it was the first seminar on Doc Watson, to my knowledge, for the Appalachian Studies program. I had a great time, a lot of fun teaching that course to six encouraging and very intelligent grad students at Appalachian State University. So I'm not sure how Doc would have felt about my teaching a course on him. You notice I waited until a couple of years after he passed away to teach that course. But we had a great time teaching it, and I learned an awful lot about this very important musician, very important North Carolinian, and I wanted to talk a little bit today about those years before Ralph Rinzler met Doc Watson. All of you, I'm sure, know Ralph Rinzler with Bill Monroe and Doc Watson and others. He met Doc in 1960 and, quote, discovered Doc. Well, Doc was already 37 years old in 1960, so he was not a young man at that time. Had already had a couple of decades of experience as a musician. So that was sort of the time period that interested me about Doc, is what came before? What came before Ralph Rinzler was there? And I knew there were some recordings that Doc had. They hadn't come out until last year is when Doc's daughter, Nancy, brought this set out, and I'll talk about that in a second. I knew there was also a rare recording at Appalachian State University in the Appalachian Collection of Doc Watson as a very young man. And I got into some of the history of that recording, which I don't think people had looked at very much. It was on the web. It's been available for about a couple of years now at this point. So I wanted to do a little bit about the history of that, and also some photographs and some memories that Doc had of his early days, going back before Ralph Rinzler in the 1960s. So if we start into the presentation here, this is an early recording of, early photograph of Doc, and I'll talk more about this. There's some controversy involving where this is. You almost always see this stated as Doc playing on the streets of Boone. It's not Boone. I'll talk about exactly where this is later. And it's not really a street. No, it's sort of a seedy group of people, actually. And I'll talk about exactly what this is. I was able to locate this. But Doc, of course, just Arthel, his given name, went by the name Doc fairly early on. So I wanted to get into this era of Doc, the black and white era, the before the folk revival Doc. So it led me back to that first Fiddler's Convention recording of Doc Watson in 1941. It was July 4th, 1941. This is at Appalachian State University, now the original transcription disc. And I was able to go into the Watauga Democrat, which is the local paper. Watauga County is the county that Boone is in. Watauga Democrat is its newspaper. And you see a Fiddler's Convention. This would have been about the 15th year or so of the Fiddler's Convention in Boone. It was a fairly big event. They had some big names. Fiddlin' John Carson was at this earlier Fiddler's Convention back in the 20s. Uncle Dave Macon played here in the 30s. So it was a fairly big event for Boone to be on the 4th of July. And it turns out that Doc Watson was one of the young amateur performers at 18 years old that came to this Fiddler's Convention and competed. Don't know if he won anything or not. The Fiddler's Conventions, as you probably know, are hit or miss. Sometimes you're lucky to get an ad in the paper. Maybe 20% of the time or so you get results. You know, so-and-so won the band contest, so-and-so won the Fiddler's contest. Very rarely, though. There's no, as far as I can tell, there's no documentation of who won this particular event, but Doc was in it and was recorded. And just to look at some of the other names in here, probably people that, if you're really, really into old-time music, you might know some of these names. Uncle Matt Crow, banjo player, was in a number of bands, and you notice we're back in that radio era, so they're marketed by what radio stations they played at. Buck Travis I'm not familiar with, but the Carolina Ramblers were a major band that had previously featured Carl Story, who's a big name in bluegrass in that area. The Johnson Brothers had a radio show as well. Probably not. They had a Johnson Family radio show at that time.
Joe Johnson?
No, it was Obie and some of the others, so I guess it's a fairly common name. So Otis Motes is a name that I didn't know of, but he was one of the early guitar harmonica players that I think, Doc never mentioned him, but it's... Right. He's a, some of these are major recording artists for the time. Otis also tap danced and sang and played harmonica and guitar all at the same time. One of the things that Doc didn't talk a lot about, there's not a lot of commentary of Doc talking about playing Fiddler's Conventions, but there is a little bit of discussion from him about feeling he, as a blind person, feeling that he was at a disadvantage because he couldn't entertain, he couldn't do show things like the fiddler trick fiddling and things like that at this time. So you get the idea that he did okay in the Fiddler's Conventions, but he preferred to play other types of venues than this. It was at the Pastime Theater. Most of the earlier Fiddler Conventions would have been at the courthouse in Boone. They had a big courtroom. They showed movies there. They had Fiddler's Conventions. And so this was a big deal at the time. The Pastime was the second theater in town in 1941. The bigger Appalachian Theater was the sort of A-movie thing. You'll notice it says on the screen, Outlaws of the Panhandle. So they had westerns and B-movies and children's movies and things of that sort. In fact, the week before this Fiddler's Convention, I looked and found there was a Tex Ritter movie at the Pastime and Goodbye, Mr. Chumps with the Three Stooges. So that gives you an idea. This was sort of the old movie theater in town, not the upscale Appalachian at that time. Doc frequently would walk into Boone from Deep Gap, which is about 10 miles outside, and he's got interviews and descriptions of him being able to gauge where he was on the street by the feel of the gravel on the road, and he could tell when a truck was coming or something. As you can imagine, a lot of times people would stop and pick him up and give him a ride into town, but to get anywhere in those days, people walked in general, and Doc was able to walk all the way in to Boone. Now, we would know nothing more about this recording, this performance. There are other early performances that Doc was involved with in fiddlers' conventions we know nothing about. But we have another Doc, and that is Doc Abrams, who was a faculty member at Appalachian State University. Actually, then it was the Appalachian State Teachers College. It had not yet become a university. And he has a connection to this area. He is from Tarboro, North Carolina, originally down east. But he went to Duke University, was a student of a man that, if you know folklore in North Carolina, you will know Frank C. Brown. So he was a student of Frank C. Brown. Brown encouraged him as an English professor to go out into the field and collect folk music, folk songs, folk variant, folk stories, things of that sort. And from 1938 to 1946, in some cases accompanied by Brown, Brown would summer in the mountains near Boone, and they would go out together and record things like fiddler's conventions. He'd have people come into his audience or into his office and record. So he had quite a collection, probably 500 or so tunes that he recorded. Really, if you look at the Frank C. Brown collection, a lot of it comes from Abrams' original recordings. In 1973, Dr. Abrams recorded these discs onto reel-to-reel and added his own commentary. I think we've got a very interesting recording I'll play in just a second. Sometimes he throws things off. Sometimes he muddles things. It's decades later. He gets confused. He doesn't read his writing. But I think we're in pretty good shape with this particular recording, the Doc Watson recording, because it was recorded on this machine here. And those of you who know anything about Wilcox Gay Recordios, send me an email. I'd love to hear any more about this machine. This was part of university property, so it wound up in the archives in our special collections. This was the actual machine that he recorded Doc Watson on in 1941 and made, as I said, about 500 disc recordings of various types. And the actual disc is here. This is a 10-inch silver-tone metalcore transcription disc, very high-quality disc. You can notice, as you imagine, from 1941, 42, 43, you get into the war years, the discs become pretty flimsy in quality because of the war. But this is not. This is a very substantial disc, very well done. You can barely read out the middle in there. Doc is actually the second, the inner band here. The first one is Watermelon on the Vine by the Johnson Brothers, a song that I associate with the Monroe Brothers. And the second one, somehow the legend became that it was Blind Boy Watson, like he was a blues player or something, but that's not what the record actually says. It says Precious Jewel, which is a song by Roy Acuff, at least mostly associated by Roy Acuff. And then it says, quote, Mr. Watson, Blind Boy. Now, I'm going to play this, and the Dr. Abrams introduces this recording in 1973 and explains it. Seems to think that Doc was 14 years old, but that can't possibly be. So if we play this recording, we'll listen to Dr. Abrams and then Doc Watson.
I just simply must make special comment about the next song you're going to hear. I recorded it on July 4th, 1941 at the Boone Fiddlers Convention. And the title of it is Precious Jewel. And my notes say that it was sung and accompanied the guitar by a Mr. Watson, a blind boy. Now this Mr. Watson is now known and acclaimed as the blind singer Doc Watson from Boone, North Carolina. At the time I recorded, he must have been about 14 years old. A few years ago, maybe five, maybe six, Doc Watson appeared in a program at Duke University, a folklore program. I took the opportunity to put on a little tape, the song which you're going to hear, and I went over to the concert and gave it to Doc. Told him who I was, shook hands with him, reminded him when I had recorded, and his memory was something incredible. He said, "Dr. Abrams, it must have been precious jewel," and that's exactly what it was. It's our feeling that this was the first time that this man had ever sung into a microphone, and this is the way he sounded then. Precious jewel, Doc Watson.
Way back in the
So that's about two-thirds of it there. I'd like to hear it just a tiny bit slower. I'm wondering, it's fairly close to pitch. It's almost in G major, which you would expect, and Doc was, among other things, a piano tuner early in his years, so he was careful about being in, not just in tune, but at standard pitch. But it's a tiny bit fast to me. But still, the voice, it's recognizable as Doc Watson, but it's a little, it's higher pitched than you would think. I can see where Abrams might have thought he was 14, but he's 18. I mean, his voice should have pretty much changed at this point. So it's an interesting recording. Well, that's true. That's true. And it's a higher range than Doc would have sung in later. But what I like about this recording, and it's, if you get your guitar out, it's the same run over and over again, but it's done with that Doc Watson, you know, it's a recognizable Doc Watson run because it's done so firmly and confidently. And it's a simple run, but you can tell he's listened to his Jimmy Rogers. He's listened to, you know, he's done his homework with that. Now, that's the only recording of Doc Watson in the Abrams collection. However, if you start looking at some of the other songs that were recorded in Watauga County for the most part, sometimes he went a county or two adjacent, there's a good bit of Doc's early repertoire in this music. Now, some of this, Froggy Went A-Courtin', Willow Garden, Pretty Polly, House Carpenter, are songs that you would see all over the South. It's nothing, you know, that you would expect. But some of these tunes, Groundhog, I Wish I Was a Mole in the Ground, Girl I Love, Don't Pay Me No Mind, the Little Omi Wise and Little Matty Groves, Wild Bill Jones. Some of these songs are really associated with Doc or become associated with Doc. And I think it's not so much taking one song here and one song there, but if you take all of these songs together, there's a good slice of Doc's repertoire here. Now, I'm not saying that Doc learned the songs from these people, but that these people and Doc learned the songs from a similar source or sources in Watauga County. So it's interesting to find this many Doc Watson songs in the Abrams collection, 1930s, 1940s. I mean, it does say that Doc didn't have the Harry Smith anthology. He lived the Harry Smith anthology. These were people around that were influencing him as a young man. And certainly people like the O.B. Johnson and the Johnson brothers were on the same show with him. So he could well have heard Groundhog from them and then adapted it later on. And, of course, we were talking about Charlie Poole and how he learned songs. Well, Doc Doc could read Braille, but you'd have to get songs in Braille, and that's not an easy thing to do. So Doc learned most of his songs definitely by ear. And he had a great sense of learning songs and learning the unusual verse. He liked that verse that nobody else sung, so he could focus on that. So I think there's a point to be made that a lot of his repertoire comes from this particular, from Watauga County. Now, moving along back to this photo and what is Hogwaller, this is the same two people in that photo that I talked about that was not the streets of Boone, that is actually the streets of Lenoir, North Carolina, which is about 38 miles from Deep Gap, so definitely a car ride for Doc. And I assume that this is Frog Green, the mandolin player on the left, a friend of Doc's. I assume that's his car. They would go down to Lenoir and what was called the Hogwaller, which was a sort of informal farmer's market. Farmers would drive their hogs into town, trade them. The people always comment in Lenoir about the hot dogs. I don't assume they turned the hogs into hot dogs that quickly, but there was certainly talk about the food, the music, the camaraderie, and things of that sort. I see Matt Ransom back there. I want to thank Matt for making that recording there. It is available on the web as well, the Doc recording. And this is actually today what this place looks like. This is the Hogwaller today. This is that same photo. So Doc would be about right here in Lenoir now. And if you're going to, you know, if you really want to look at the brick lineup and things of that sort, I actually took photos of the brick and lined it up. It's become kind of a sticking point between Lenoir and Boone, because Boone has claimed this photo for so long, and the people in Lenoir actually have this photo, a huge version of this photo in the hospital thereby, and it says Hogwaller, 1949, Doc Watson in Lenoir. So there's a city rivalry coming in here, and I'm pretty sure it is in Lenoir at this time. And it's important because Doc was given his name, his nickname, in Lenoir. He was playing on the radio there with Frog Green, the mandolin player. There's no recordings of them, but you can imagine sort of brother duet kind of things, mandolin, guitar, harmony singing, things of that sort. And so Doc, right around the corner, played and for that type of sound. Now we've got a different Doc Watson if we go into the 1950s. And some of you may have seen this recording on the web. It came up a few years ago. This one, the color version, is by Hugh Morton, that many of you may know if you're a UNC basketball fan. He was the official photographer for the basketball team for years, for decades. He is also the man that owns Grandfather Mountain. His family owned Grandfather Mountain. And I think, I don't know, but everyone who's seen this photo would say this must be singing on the mountain at Grandfather Mountain for Hugh to take a photo. You also notice Doc's mic stand here. It's a stick, yeah, with a mic tied on it. That's not the first thing that guitarists will notice. The first thing guitarists will notice, well, my gosh, Doc, in both photos here has the same, it's a 1952 trapeze tailpiece Les Paul. And Doc talks about this instrument and actually has still, the family still owns the instrument. I'll talk about that in just a second. And I think a lot of people have looked at photos like this and thought, well, Doc was playing rockabilly. Doc was rocking it out. I don't know. They see, people now see a Les Paul and think it's got to be rock music. Well, the recordings that Doc made from the 1950s, some of which in groups similar to this, some of which are home recordings, I think reflect more of the original use of the Les Paul guitar. They reflect Les Paul more than Jeff Beck or something from the 1970s. So Doc, if we could listen to that second CD, number seven, track number seven. This will be a little bit of Doc in the 1950s playing the Les Paul.
When it's twilight on the train, the ripple of the stream is my song. When it's twilight on the train and I rest once more, my ceiling is the sky and the grass on which I lie is my floor. And the grass on which I lie.
I think there you can definitely hear Doc's voice. I mean, this is before the folk revival and all, but it's that more baritone, relaxed vocal style and a pop music style. And I think that was the type of music that they were playing here. If you realize he is a musician that's playing for, yes? Yeah, there is, it's a very pop sounding 1-6-4-5-1 progression, that kind of thing, yeah. Which, the movie? Yeah, which was a big show in Boone at that time, so yeah. Yes, he's got two things going on there. He's got electric bass and electric guitar, and he's overdubbed them with his voice, so... You'll remember Doc when he was at the School of the Blind. He had a difficult relationship and quit the school rather abruptly for reasons that he talks about. But he was trained as an electrician, and he always said that if he had been able to see, he would have been an electrical engineer. That's what he really wanted to be. It's kind of if it was anybody else, you'd think, yeah, sure, an electrical engineer. But I think Doc really felt that he would rather have stayed home, you know, worked on electronics and things of that sort. So it was, and he did a lot of work on the Les Paul. If you know anything about the trapeze tailpiece Les Paul, Les Paul actually had an extended lawsuit with Gibson about the design of the tailpiece. It was almost unplayable. The way it was, so almost all of the people who bought this instrument had to adapt it, usually changed the tailpieces out and did some things with the bridge to make it more playable, to make it stay in tune better. And Doc did that fairly early on, although I don't see any evidence of that here. But he played this guitar he brought this guitar to Ralph Renzler in 1960. You can imagine what Ralph Renzler thought when he, you know, here comes this guy with a Les Paul. And Doc actually, to record, Doc actually had to go out and borrow a flat top, an acoustic guitar, because this was his guitar. This was what he was playing with. Let's play another recording from that, number 22. This is a song called Pharaoh that Doc wrote, but never recorded again. It was one of Nancy's favorites, and she put it out on this box set, the Milestones box set. But she's, I don't know if Doc has felt it was too close musically to some other tunes that you might hear here. But let's play number 22.
Don't let his people go. Yeah, Pharaoh, Pharaoh, the Lord's gonna cry your name.
I think you can really recognize Doc's style in that. I hear Walk On Boy a little bit, which is a Mel Tillis song that Doc did, and also a little bit of Fever. I don't know. So maybe Doc felt, I better not try to record this one or do anything with it, but who knows.
What kind of circumstance was it that Ralph Renzler first heard of that? What kind of a group was he playing with?
He at that point he was playing electric guitar with people like Jack Williams, who's the guitarist here. So, and Rinsler was looking for Clarence Ashley. He wasn't looking for Doc. And Clarence Ashley said, well, and this was an interesting thing. I've got a student that's actually following this up now, is, well, we have to have two guitar players for a band. And that sort of goes back to Maynard's Mountaineers and some of these bands that you had a guitarist that did bass runs and a guitarist that played chords. And that was Clarence Ashley's view at that point, that if we're going to get a band together from this guy from New York who wants to record us, we need two guitarists. And Doc was one of the guitarists that he brought to that session, and Doc showed up with this guitar. The story I heard to finish off the Les Paul, was that in about 10 years ago or so, Doc... one of the knobs had broken off, and it is early plastic-like things. One of the knobs had broken off, and Doc gave the guitar to his grandson, Richard, to take to a local music store to just have the knob replaced. Well, the person at the music store got all excited because it was a rare guitar, and it was Doc Watson's guitar. It had been well played, so he decided he would redo it. And I heard that not only did they redo the electronics, but they refinished it, which I found is just unconscionable. Now, that could be true. That could be the story. Or it could have also been Doc's way of saying, stop asking about my Les Paul. Yeah. It got ruined. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think either could be possible there. I can't see a professional taking a 52 Les Paul and refinishing it at that point. But the guitar was with him for a number of years. Now, my last slide here before I wind up. There are only seven tunes that have been re-released to this point of Doc in the 1950s. And they're all in Nancy Watson, Doc's only daughter, the four CD set that she brought out, the Milestone set. And we've talked a little bit about the sacred harp and things of that sort. It's made in the shape and size of a sacred harp. Nancy wanted that and thought that Doc would appreciate that. So, but what I've found, Roy Andrade and Nancy Watson brought this out last year. An interesting recording of Stardust and some other things on here, but we're not seeing 1950s rockabilly, and I think that's what people had imagined Doc playing on that Les Paul, but I think what he was playing was pop music for the most part. So in other words, what I get from all of this is that Doc was a versatile musician. He was able to adapt to the times. If people wanted fiddle music, or you didn't have a fiddle player in the band, he could bring his electric guitar and play the fiddle songs. He talks a lot about playing fiddle tunes on electric guitar because they couldn't get a fiddle player to show up for a dance. And I think that was great training for him. He was able to adapt straight to the acoustic guitar from there, and it worked great. But when the folk revival came along later, he was able to go back to that folk tradition that he had started with and was able to recreate folk music, not in a learned kind of way, but just the old songs that he used to sing that people around him used to sing. So I think he was a versatile musician. I think in many ways typical of musicians from Watauga County at that time period, in that you can play a little pop music, a little old-time music, some fiddle music. What do you want to hear? He's playing on the streets, he's playing in dance bands and playing VFWs and American Legion halls and things of that sort. He played what he had to play to survive. Thank you.
Let's have one question. I want to make sure our presenters all get equal time and that we all get to go to lunch. So a brief question.
We've already had a couple during the...
No?
That's fine. Thank
you. Okay. Thank you. It's so nice to hear so many of my favorite musicians being dealt with so beautifully. That was really a nice talk, Gary. Thank you.